Hello and welcome to episode 6 of Sounding Board. I'm Bob Langham, and on tonight's show we're going to be talking about festivals, all aspects of them, not really necessarily going through the lineups of all the festivals in the UK and elsewhere this summer, because that way we would still be here in about 100 millennia's time. But festivals is the topic this week, and then we're going to be following up by discussing James Blake's new album, The Colour in Anything. But first of all, in time-honoured fashion, the music news. And Neil, you've got a couple of things to talk about.
Yeah, so one thing I wanted to mention, just the other day, I went to the Double Dot Bash, which is run by the promoters in Reading, Double Dot Dash, and it's their annual sort of celebration of both local music and also kind of interest in experimental music from out of town. Happens at the South Street Arts Centre in Reading. Day-long festival over two stages. First time I'd been, thoroughly enjoyed it. Would highly recommend it for anyone who gets around in time for next year's one. That saw some really enjoyable sets from Hey Colossus, London kind of heavy psych six piece. They were brilliant. Grey Hairs, who are from Nottingham, who are a sort of four piece, heavy, vaguely kind of bluesy rock band. And Shit and Shine as well, who is a kind of long running experimental outfit. The set they were doing, I think they've done all, they have all kinds of different sets, but the set they were doing was a kind of glitchy techno kind of dance set, which was really, really fun. So that's something I've been out in Soul Live that I really enjoyed. The other thing I was just going to mention in terms of new stuff was a new track by the band Martha, who are a four-piece kind of indie pop punk outfit from Durham. I think, Ben, you might be able to tell me if this is legitimate or not, or if I've fallen for for an internet pun. They're apparently from a mining village in Durham called Pity Me.
Does that sound heard of this?
Okay,
yeah, right. there was a football team actually,
okay.
And it was back in as a bit of a non-league buff back in the 80s. And there is a team, something and Pity Me. Colliery Welfare.
Right.
Sounds like a union team.
Okay.
So yeah, I think you're right.
Okay. So that being the case, they've released one album on Fortuna Pop, which is a great British indie pop label, called Court and Strong, came out in 2014, which was really, really good. And they've released a new track called Ice Cream and Sunscreen, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and I'd recommend checking out if you're into kind of British indie pop and also maybe kind of like literate kind of punk stuff. Really, really good band.
Yep, sounds good. And Ben, you had a couple of things you wanted to mention?
Well, a couple of things on the sort of festival topic, really. A couple of stories of people being dropped from festival bills. So I think it's probably a week and a bit since Azealia Banks was dropped.
Oh, yes.
From the bill for the Rinse FM Festival Born and Bred, which is taking place in London first weekend in June. It all started when she accused former One Direction man Zayn Malik of plagiarism on Instagram, and then he sort of reacted apparently dismissively to this, and then followed a tirade of very offensive racial slurs on Twitter. She initially delivered the most unapologetic apology I think I've ever read. She apologised for the way people feel, but she was completely unrepentant about using the words themselves. She claimed to be exercising her right to creative freedom, which I thought was an interesting defence. She's since apologised more sincerely, but she's been dropped anyway. Not the only controversial thing she said recently. She also expressed support for Donald Trump, claiming he would be the president that the US deserves. But more recently, I think on Friday, it broke that Eagles of Death Metal have been dropped from a couple of bills of French festivals, Cabaret Vert and Rock en Seine, for the comments that the frontman Jesse Hughes made in the wake of the in interviews following the Bataclan attack last November. In one interview, he claimed that the sort of strict French gun laws were responsible for the terrorists being allowed to go unchallenged. He's actually got form as an NRA supporter, so it's not surprising, really. He also, in another interview, hinted that the security guards, or some of the security guards, may have been in on the attack, which drew an immediate rebuttal from the venue. He's actually apologised since, but that's obviously not been good enough for the organisers, and they've both dropped him and the band. It's a very disappointing response. They had a lot of goodwill for them, I think, after that, and it seems to have evaporated. He seems to be having a lot of difficulty kind of coming to terms with things, really. So
yeah, it's a very sad postscript indeed. Yeah. But on the subject of festivals, we're now going to look at them as an entity and just the state of them at the moment. And Ben, you're going to lead the conversation.
Yeah, well, you've sort of mentioned already the we could be listing the lineups for UK festivals for millennia for this summer. So first of all, simple question: are there too many festivals? Have we actually reached market saturation point, Neil?
I don't want to get too much into in my day territory, but growing up in Scotland, I could be wrong, but there basically just used to be one music festival, Tea in the Park, which everybody went to, and the upshot of that was it attracted really big bands because it was the only place that those big bands could play if they wanted to play in Scotland, whether they were international acts or British acts from the other end of the country. I think obviously that kind of economy, that monopoly that it had, was probably not hugely healthy in terms of maybe exposing people to bands that were kind of outside the mainstream of kind of indie culture. But there's possibly a conversation to be had about, you know, if every farmer who has a spare field somewhere in Britain that's, free in June and July, you know, there seems to have someone pitching tents on it and putting on, you know, a stage.
Yes, I mean, I would agree. I mean, I got DIY's magazine's very helpful festival guide the other day and went through it, and, it did take me several hours. I mean, it's just extraordinary how many there are. I mean, and, how could you possibly choose between them? And I think there's an issue, Ben, which I think was maybe we're going to talk about in a bit.
Well, yeah. I mean, my argument would be sort of be slightly contrary and say that it hasn't reached saturation point, or maybe it has, but it's all a case of survival of the fittest. You know, sure. If there are too many, then the ones that aren't good enough, aren't up to scratch, will die out.
Yeah.
I'm not a Tory, but in this instance, I'll say let the market decide on this. You know, any festivals that fail to grab the attention or have enough character or individuality of their own, then, and fail to sell tickets, then they're deservedly going to die, really.
Yeah. One thing I was going to come back on, Ben, was I started to notice more and more on festival announcements, particularly for newer festivals, that they're actually having exclusive announcements for certain bands to say, like, this is their only UK performance at this particular festival. And I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, I suppose if you can't get along to that particular weekend it's on, then you're going to miss a band you really want to see. Obviously, for the artists, in order for them to remain exclusive, I guess they're, you know, being able to command a higher fee than if they were just sort of doing the circuit. So it's an interesting kind of change, I think, in how festivals have traditionally kind of booked specific bands to play at them.
Yeah, I mean, coming back to the idea about the specialist festivals, there's still some good ones. I mean, WOMAD is still around, which is good to see. And then there's a really good one in Oxfordshire, Supernormal, in Braziers Park, which is a real kind of weird and wonderful one. And that obviously attracts a certain type of audience. And then you've got the likes of Crop Ready, which are good for the folkies.
Wood as well. It's just Wood. Last weekend, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but there are just so many where you think they're just trying to get the indie bands at De No Jour, who are the particularly got the albums out this year.
And they're
year,
also, and, I mean, we'll probably talk about this in more depth, but they're also the ones where music doesn't even really seem to be that much of a focus. Mm. There's the Wilderness Festival, which is, again, another one in Oxfordshire. And there's also the Big Feastival?
Big Feastival.
Which is Alex James from Blur and Jamie Oliver, and it's it's a sort of, it's more a food festival, but it just happens to have bands playing at
it. Well, it's a food festival with music in inverted commas on the side, isn't it? Kaiser Chiefs and Reefer both on the bill. Yeah. I mean, Wilderness, I have no idea who Wilderness is aimed at. I mean, they've got Flaming Lips performing Soft Blood this year, which is amazing.
Brilliant, yeah.
But nothing else.
Well, I think they had Bjork last year, didn't they? Which is incredible.
And they've had Spiritualize and things, but this year there's nothing else of any note. If you don't count Wilderness Orchestra tribute to David Bowie, I mean, I don't count that.
Depends how much you like cheese, though, I have to say.
I've got Big Festival in my notes here, and I've just, written Unholy Union of Alex James and Jamie Oliver. So, one of the things you mentioned, Rob, is when we were sort of compiling thoughts about what we might talk about for this, was that looking at the Glastonbury headliners, they're obviously the ones that a lot of people pay attention. People aren't necessarily going to be festival goers. So Adele and Coldplay are two of the three headliners this year. Does it matter that they're such mainstream headliners? And you were kind of wondering whether it was having more cutting edge, grime artists like Skepta and Stormzy actually further down the bill. Does that help balance things out?
I think it does to an extent. I mean, I must admit I'm a little bit of a naysayer on Glastonbury simply because I missed the boat and have never been. And so the worse it gets, the better for me in saying, people who are in their early 20s now are saying, why would anybody ever want to go to that? So it's... If you look at the bill as a whole, there's still an incredible amount of good stuff on there, and I think there's something for everyone, so fair play. I mean, it is potentially going to be the final year, actually, at the farm this year. I think. And Adele and Coldplay, I don't know. I mean, it's they've been down this route before. I mean, it's very difficult to be judgmental, isn't it? I mean, I think I don't think it necessarily attracts, worse people by having those people on the bill. I think, Glastonbury has its own kind of character and attracts, a crowd who are into lots of different things, and I don't think it will spoil it particularly, no.
I mean, I would like to give a fairly robust defence of the Glastonbury, because I've not been for since 2011, but I think I did 10 or 11 of festivals, so I'm a huge, huge fan, hoping to go back one day, I guess. But I think it's a festival that often gets a sort of slightly sniffy response from musos, which I would say is actually very much undeserved. I mean, you can look at the surface and see Adele and Coldplay headlining, but the 2010 lineup, for instance, was one of the best I've ever had the pleasure of enjoying anywhere. And actually this year, if you look at the list, I mean, PJ Harvey, LCD Sound System, Foals, Savages, Bat for Lashes, the Sigur Rós and Explosions in the Sky, ZZ Top, there's bands you won't see anywhere else. But then also, I mean, if we're saying that Adele and Coldplay are really safe choices, I think in the past they've not been afraid to pick Jay-Z, Metallica, Kanye West, and then they've had, they've been accused of them being un-Glastonbury headliners and had petitions, which for my money are the sort of things started by and signed by complete morons. We don't understand there's a wealth of other things on. You don't have to go and watch the headliners. The headliners are just there for the TV.
I think when the anti-Glastonbury kind of brigade was chased out of town the day that Noel Gallagher became their spokesman, really.
Exactly.
I'm not sure when that was, but 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, it was the year that Jay-Z played. And he came on stage playing Wonderwall as a response. So you were talking Neil about sort of ploys for getting people signed up, and one is this idea of billing acts as exclusives, which for me can be slightly irritating to feel like you're getting your hand forced to go or something. But another one is this idea of sort of secrecy and having secret sets and rumours flying around. And there's actually a festival knee deep, I think you mentioned, Rob, that is actually completely secret location with no lineup.
Yeah, it's in Liscard in Cornwall, or according to DIY magazine anyway. And I presume that the only thing people have to go on is whether it was on last year, which I presume it was, and so I presume you had quite a decent bill, and so people had taken a chance. I mean, to be fair, my girlfriend and I did book truck festival tickets without knowing who was going to be on the bill. I got them as a Christmas present because we just enjoyed the vibe so much a couple of years ago, and other friends of mine have said the same thing. They don't really care who plays. They just like the way it's organised. They like how relaxed it is, etc. So I presume it's in a nice location. But at the same time, with all the choice of festivals, that is quite an ask, isn't it? Expecting people to shell out.
Glastonbury is a complete leap of faith. Well, sorry, it's not a leap of faith. It's people sign up completely blind, and it's not announced for ages, but people know it's Glastonbury, and people sign up. Whereas for a small festival like that, I would have thought it's a bit of a gamble to kind of...
It's far as well. I mean, it's a long way.
I suppose it's, you know, depending on when they're doing it, Cornwall's probably the part of the country that's most likely to have good weather, isn't it?
Yes,
so if they're
true,
doing it mid-July, you can always just have a nice trip to Cornwall and lie on
exactly.
the beach, even
yeah.
if you don't think the music's that much cop.
Then you get, like, on the terms of sort of secret sets, there's the sort of tradition that's developing where there'll be a Friday evening secret set at the Park Stage at Glastonbury, and 2010 it was Thom Yorke with Johnny Greenwood, and the following year it was Radiohead. It's become a bit of a sort of tradition, so it's not actually much of a secret anymore. And for my money, it works to a certain extent, but that stage hasn't got a powerful enough sound system to broadcast it. Everybody actually wants to be there. And the Radiohead set, for instance, I thought was an absolute disaster because you just couldn't hear unless you were really close in. And they were playing King of Limbs stuff. So
and if you want to listen to more about Radiohead, our previous episode, if you haven't listened to it, we talk about the latest Radiohead album.
You've mentioned Double Up Dash, which is a one-day festival in one venue, two runs in one venue. There's actually sort of increasing number of festivals which are multi-venue, either across a whole city or within areas of a city. And there's also festivals at holiday camps like ATP, which maybe no more, but there are other festivals like that. So in other words, a festival these days doesn't necessarily mean camping and festival toilets. What would you say are the advantages or disadvantages to that kind of festival?
Well, I mean, there's the possibility to not be beholden to one particular supplier of alcohol, which is often an issue. It's you become very much literally a captive audience at certain music festivals, don't you? And you know, if you're in a city, you know, then there's also the opportunity to actually see a city that you maybe don't know and have the big added bonus of getting an opportunity to go into lots of different venues and see different parts of that city and see lots of good bands in the process. I think it's a very different thing from what you get when you go to a music festival that's, you know, in a field, a traditional festival. You're kind of buying into a sort of kind of collectivism, a kind of an idea around, you know, being out in nature and all that kind of tradition. But I think, I think the two, my opinion is the two can kind of coexist quite happily. And, you know, I think from the perspective of people playing in bands, both are kind of great things to be involved in, you know. So long as you're, you know, playing decent venues that are sort of got a good amount of people in them and they've got decent sound systems and that kind of thing. I think both can be work perfectly well together.
Yeah,
I mean, I was going to say that I think one thing is that the weather's obviously irrelevant, so you can have, you know, the weather doesn't affect anything, and that also means that they can take place outside traditional festival season, which means that, you know, clashes with festival, other festivals can be avoided because there's so many in the summer that there's always, every weekend there's two or three festivals going on of various sizes, but you can have them actually all the way through the year. Another few that I've, of this sort of festival I've been to, I really like the idea of this, it being a boost to the local scenes. They're very good for promoting local bands, but there's also touring things. So Sounds Familiar, the City in Salford is a really good festival in May. I think it was the first weekend in May. Southsea Fest, which is back up and running this year in Southsea. The Great Escape's just been on in Brighton. I think it's a similar sort of thing.
Tramlines in Sheffield as well. It's a very strong tradition.
Dr. Dot, I think, which is that's still going. That was in Nottingham and Bristol, I think, wasn't it?
Bristol.
And as discussed on the episode 5 of the pod, the Punt in Oxford, which is just an evening, but you can see...
Well, there was Gathering as well. There was Gathering for a couple of years, which unfortunately has not happened, I think, for the last 2 or 3 years. That was a similar sort of thing.
We've just had the Great Escape in Brighton as well, which is a kind of long tradition of, you know, promoting a lot of new acts as well.
So we've kind of touched on this already, but... with talking about the big festival and wilderness, I mean, do festivals need to diversify, you think? We talked about that in record, the section on record shops in episode 3. Do they need to do something more than just selling records, and do festivals need to do more than just having music on?
Well, I went to Latitude a few years ago, and I have to say one of the things that I enjoyed the most about it was the spoken word The poetry, the comedians, like literary readings. I've also been to the Hay Book Festival, which I recommend to anybody. And I really like that, actually. I mean, it just seemed more varied, and there were some great people. I remember seeing a great sort of Simon Armitage kind of set, which we could call it a set, which was really good. And there were also like up and coming, you know, kind of poets and comedians, and sort of genuinely really well curated. So I'm all for that. And on the food and drink front, I mean, festival food was always like really expensive. So I wonder if at least, you know, maybe you're getting a bit of quality now. Yeah. You know, you can certainly, I mean, that has been transformed. I mean, not so much. I mean, obviously, Jamie Oliver and Alex James are taking it sort of in one direction. But even at a normal festival, I mean, the range of beers you can get now is, you know, craft beer and real ales. And also, you know, food, you know, sort of really nicely put together kind of burgers and things like that. So all to be welcomed. And I'd also like to mention Truck Festival again. One thing I really like about Truck is they let you take your own food and drink in. So,
yeah.
And they're not the only ones, I think, you know. So yeah, I mean, I think overall, they don't need to necessarily, but I think it shows a bit of imagination.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, I think, well, you said they don't need to. I think there's a market forces thing at play, isn't there?
Yeah.
Where, you know, if you're trying to show what you can offer, which is different from the festival that's on 50 miles down the road the weekend before, and you're kind of pitching to a roughly similar audience, if you have all those kind of additional, you know, things, like you've got someone great who's doing the food, you've got a really interesting spoken word tent, and maybe they don't, it starts to look like there's just a bit more going on, even if a lot of the bands playing might be sort of a similar kind of level.
Yeah. Yeah.
So on to economics. Now, Glastonbury tickets this year, I think, were £228 plus £5 booking fee. And even Green Mile, I think, was £175 this year. So are UK festivals too expensive, or is the cost justified?
Yeah. It's, I think it's difficult for a young person who's maybe at school and is wanting to go to their first festival. That's an awful lot of money to put down. I mean, that's, you know, an awful lot of your Saturday job wages you've got to save up to have a chance to actually go to one of these things. And, you know, there's a chance for some of those festivals, they'll have sold out before you can even get the money together, you know. I know a lot of festivals now have these kind of pay an installment systems, don't they, which allow people to sort of pay it off over a longer period of time. But I mean, we're talking about the, you know, sort of food and drink at festivals getting better, and undoubtedly it has, but there's a cost associated with that. It's an awful lot more expensive now if you're just going to sort of, you know, buy stuff on site to eat, you know. So there's a kind of, there are all kinds of other associated costs that come with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, I looked at the Green Man bill and I was staggered. I think it's absolutely sensational.
It's a really good,
fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, and £175, I mean, I think Neil's point's just brilliant. I mean, it's almost like the old days of early 70s prog rock, where presumably only middle-aged people like me could afford to go to bands for a while, and then that's what punk cleared out, you know, like it was more the kind of homespun stuff, so... yeah, it is too much, because particularly if you think Green Man is in a sort of fairly remote part of the country, apologies to people who live in the area, but it's in sort of Brecon, Black Mountains kind of way, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you know, so you really are looking at, you know, best part £500 a person if you're talking about the kind of, once you get travelling, food, drink, staying, everything, you know, which you could say is great, but it is only a couple of days, and you know, you'd want £500, you want like 7 days away, don't you, really?
Sure.
And I think some places are actually now letting people pitch the tents for a longer period of time, you know, like 2 or 3 days after.
Well, I mean Glastonbury, I always used to go on a Wednesday, first thing on a Wednesday, and leave on a Monday, so you feel like it, you know, you're paying the cost of a holiday, and you actually feel like you're going on holiday.
Yeah.
I mean, just to sort of play devil's advocate a little bit. I remember seeing Brian Wilson at Glastonbury in 2005 and thinking it was one of the best sets I'd ever seen anywhere. And getting home and thinking, oh, look, he's playing in the NEC in Birmingham. I'd really like to go to that and take my girlfriend. and the tickets were £60 a pop. Yeah. So actually that was more than a third of the cost of the Glastonbury ticket. So you don't have to see an awful lot in Glastonbury to feel like you're making your money back. I appreciate as a young person it's a big cost, but actually when you factor in what you can see and gig prices factor into that festival price, I don't actually think they're not unreasonable, I would say. Mm. It's just as a lump sum, certainly it's a lot of money. And then you've got, as you say, the other things on top. You've got transport, you've got food and drink, you've got your jester's hat, you've got your car.
Like the absolute essentials.
Personally, I have no regrets about in the past spending money on a festival rather than a holiday. Things have changed now a bit, but it's a big choice, I guess, for a lot of people. So then, I don't know whether either of you have been to a festival abroad, but do you think it represents better value for money, or do they offer a better experience, do you think?
Well, I suppose it ties in what you just said, because, you know, a festival or holiday, go to a festival abroad and you can do both, which is something definitely to recommend it. We talked a few podcasts back about Primavera and the lineup for that, which is absolutely incredibly strong. And then you've got the added benefit of the fact that you're in Barcelona, which is a fantastic city, and you get the opportunity to explore that as well.
Because music didn't start until sort of late afternoon. Certainly, when I went to the one in Porto, it didn't start till about 4 or 5. So you've actually got the day explore the town.
It's good.
And it's with kind of low cost flights, you know, it is so much more easier to say, oh, I will go and give a festival, you know, in the Czech Republic or something a go, because, you know, it's really not adding a huge amount onto the cost of a ticket to take a flight over there on EasyJet or something like that. Other low cost airlines are available, of course.
Someone from Scotland or the North East, I imagine it's probably cheaper to go to a European festival potentially than to go to somewhere like Green Man or End of the Road.
Depending on how you get there. If you're training it anywhere, then you will be looking at a fairly hefty travel cost.
There's quite a good one, I forget the name, in Gdynia in Poland, which is on the Baltic coast, which has got a really good bill. And I think in the past there's been some really good ones in like Novi Sad in Serbia and places. So I think they're good options, although I have to say the low cost flights of the early noughties are not around anymore, and particularly if the low cost carriers know a whole load of people are descending somewhere. I think Neil, certainly in the past, I think you've looked at that Pitchfork Festival in Chicago and been a bit tempted, haven't you?
But, you know, again, it's it's obviously going to be a big outlay if you decide to go and do something like that.
And you do it as part of a holiday.
Of course you would. Yeah, you absolutely would. You do it as part of a bigger trip. And, there's some other kind of great festivals that they've got. Sasquatch is another one, which is, you know, always showcases really interesting as well as big bands playing as well.
So
we kind of touched on this as well. Festivals represent a good opportunity to make money because of the high prices and a captive audience, especially somewhere like Green Man, where there isn't any, it's quite remote. I mean, Reading, you can walk into the town, for instance. So does that mean that music fans are exploited, do you think?
Possibly. I mean, not entirely. I think it just depends on how they're set up. I mentioned Truck earlier on, where, you know, you're allowed to take your own food and drink in, you're allowed to leave the site and go for a beer in the local pub, all that kind of thing. And, you know, when I went to Latitude, I'm not sure whether it's like that now, but it did seem as if it was like a three-line whip at the gate in terms of being searched and, like, eating and drinking the corporate stuff, you know. So it's probably changed now, but that was my experience then. I'm just fascinated to know, and I don't know enough about it, how much it clearly is a viable proposition, a more than viable proposition for the people who lay these things on, you know, like, and, you know, there must be a good way of making money, particularly for the really big festivals. You know, I think they must be making a lot of money.
You're talking about the organisers here?
I know
one or two people who've actually had stalls at festivals, and they get charged an awful lot of money to have a stall.
Yeah, they would.
So then the prices to the punter then kind of reflect that, I guess.
Yeah.
The arena thing is one of my... We're going to come on this in a minute, but one of my real bugbears in that your movement's restricted, but you're also restricting what you can take in. Mm-hmm. And that definitely pushes up the cost, because not only can you not take in stuff that you bought in a supermarket in there, you're then beholden to their prices of, you know, £4.50, £5 a pint. Mm-hmm. V Festival is particularly bad for that. Reading and Leeds has that. ATP had it as well. they at least they had some decent beer on when you were in there. Mm. But the likes of Glastonbury, Green Man, Truck, you've got complete freedom of movement, which I think is really good.
Yeah, mm. I think there is, to use the term that you said, there is exploitation, but I think you're kind of being knowingly exploited in some of these situations. You do sign up for it, but it's certainly, yeah, it definitely sticks in your craw when you're sort of being told, oh, you can only get into this part of the festival if you do X, Y, Z, which is not really what you want to hear when you've put down an awful lot of money to even get in the first place.
So does anyone have any particular bugbears about festivals and anything that makes them think twice about going to a festival?
Well, that would be the main thing for me, really, what you just mentioned. I mean, I think it's just if someone says you've got to drink Carling or something like that, I mean, I can't think of anything worse. And actually, festivals are a bit ahead of gig venues now in that respect, you know, in terms of offering more choice. But yes, I mean, I think it's just being told what to do. It's any of that kind of, just mind speak, really. I don't want, you know, I want to have some freedom within the encompassing nature of the festival to enjoy what I like doing as well. So,
I mean, one of the things I was going to mention is this idea of corporate sponsorship and official partners and things. Now, instinctively, my reaction is to say that that's not a good thing. But the 1-2-3-4 festival, which is actually coming back this year after 3 years away, 4 years away, I think, is a small festival in East London. Very beginning of September. Now, I went to that in 2010 and again in 2012, and it was very heavily sponsored by Converse and Copperberg, people who want to be, you know, cool brands. And it was sort of the branding was everywhere. But on the flip side, tickets were £20, I think. And it was the lineup was fantastic for £20-25. And it's because it's got corporate sponsorship. So it swings and roundabouts, really. I ended up the first year paying more for a taxi from Didcot train station back home than I did for my festival ticket. So it's ridiculous, really. And one other thing I think you mentioned, Rob, is stage clashes. You know, it can be frustrating, but for me, it's a nice problem to have, really, better than have a lineup where there's just nothing you want to see.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I think so. It's just, it could be a bit, yeah, it's just one of those things, isn't it? But it's part of the fun in a way, maybe, trying to see like half of one act and half of the other. Yeah. So, yeah, so I wouldn't put that as a real pet peeve.
Finally, on this subject, there was a recent article on Noisy, which is Vice's music website, proclaiming that the golden age of festivals is over, which sounds like a sort of hackneyed old argument. How many times have we heard that? Rock is dead, etc. But it was actually, the argument was slightly different. The argument was that the sort of advent of VIP packages and boutique camping and exclusive camping areas sort of run counter to the collectivist, we're all in this together ethos, which I think you mentioned before, Neil. Does that actually matter? Is the golden age over? Was there a golden age?
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? It's, you know, once you start getting into that sort of phraseology, it becomes a little bit sort of toe-curling, really,
I
think.
In my day.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. It's a bit like the thing that Ian Mackay always says, of like people telling him, oh, punk's dead, and he said, oh, okay, well, I'm still involved in punk. When do you think punk died? And he said, well, I stopped going to shows, you know, like, but I think, I can agree with the sentiments. I mean, actually kind of unpacking that we're all in it together ethos, you know, it depends how you want to kind of look at history in terms of festivals. And it could be said that festival kind of, you know, music festival culture, the Isle of Wight Festival and Woodstock kind of grew in a time where that kind of collectivist ideology with, you know, not just, you know, the hippie movement, but also kind of big trade unions and things kind of held sway in the 60s and 70s. You know, I think you'd be quite hard pressed these days to say that ideology is still the predominant ideology in society. It's not, you know, people, they want to engage politically, they're more sort of going on Twitter and ranting about something, you know, than sort of thinking, oh, well, we're all in this together, you know. So it's hard to equate that, I think, to festival setup, you know, and particularly to sort of say that, you know, glamping is, you know, an inherently sort of bourgeois, you know, activity. But, you know, it's certainly not something I'd be particularly keen to do myself.
Mm. No, I mean, even I'm not old enough to remember the hippie era, but I think if there was a golden age, that probably was it, you know, the late 60s, you know, although Altamont, obviously, yeah, maybe wasn't quite so much fun.
No.
Certainly compared to the early 90s, mid 90s, I think it's better now. You know, I would say, you know, like, there are, you know, because there just wasn't the choice, and now you can see more. So,
yeah. What I'd say, to be slightly contrary, is instinctively I'd say this idea of sort of stratification in packages that people buy is a bad thing, but actually, as someone with a young family, it's actually potentially going to make festivals more inclusive rather than exclusive, because I'd be more inclined to go. I mean, you say you wouldn't do glamping, but actually, it's, you know, comfort, and it might entice the rest of the family to come as well.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a very glamorous tent already. I don't need to pay for one that's any more glamorous. Yeah.
So, you know, if some people might say that these things are attracting the wrong sort of people who wouldn't otherwise go, but I'm not necessarily going to make that claim. I'm just saying it's probably quite good for families.
Yeah, a quick word on that noisy article, which we'll sort of post up another link to it on Twitter, is the pictures are glorious.
Yes.
Just absolutely unmissable summations of what festivals are about in the modern era. Okay, all right, well, great discussion about festivals. They're very interesting. We are off to one or two, I think, possibly, aren't we? I mean, I mentioned I'm going to Truck, and
I'm going to be going to South Sea Fest this year. That's not until October, though. Anything else?
Still a bit TBC for me at the moment.
So there's plenty of choice. I mean, that is almost one of the problems. So we're going to move on to this month's album. It's an album that's been out a few weeks now. It's by an interesting character, James Blake. It's his third album, The Colour in Anything, and he's been very critically acclaimed throughout his career. Very strikingly tall, creative performer who, arguably, I don't know, I mean, we'll probably talk about this in a minute, came out of the ashes or the early machinations of dubstep. I mean, I don't know how much that's really true, but we can talk about that in a minute. Quite different from his other albums. I mean, certainly his first album didn't overstay its welcome. It was like a fairly short, you know, maybe 35-minute affair, which was pretty unlike anything else that had been out at that time, and it was quite an interesting addition to the scene. I personally hadn't heard his second album, but this one now has wrong-footed a lot of people with, like, sort of, you know, 73 minutes, which is quite extraordinary, really, for this type of music. If you don't know what he sounds like and you don't know what dubstep is, I guess it's like kind of very low-key electronica, and his voice is very, very dominant. It's kind of like a warbling, very emotional voice, which maybe even recalls people like kind of Anthony and the Johnsons, or, you know, and there's a lot of auto-tune on there. He's got some collaborators on this new album in the style of the likes of Chemical Brothers used to do. They used to sort of like check out who's hot at the moment and would just go and get them to come on the album. He's got someone with a ridiculously similar voice in Bon Iver appearing on one track, and it's called I Need a Forest Fire. And then Frank Ocean, who had probably the album of, was it 2013?
Seems right,
I think. He appears on the track My Willing Heat. So, interesting stuff. What did you make of it, fellas?
Well, I actually found it. I read a review somewhere that suggests it was quite old-fashioned, and that is true in some ways. His style generally, if you strip all things away, it's quite an old-fashioned sort of style. Obviously, quite a sort of sensitive soul.
Yeah, it's almost kind of croonerish, isn't it, in a way? Yeah,
refracted to this sort of contemporary R&B and dubstep. And for me, I kind of thought it was possibly all a bit Emperor's New Clothes. It's kind of, is there actually, you know, when you strip that away, is what's still there that good? I mean, the closest comparison I could think for a lot of it was Perfume Genius, which, you know, the sort of melancholy and the melodrama and the sparse piano, and there's quite a lot of electronic on the last Perfume Genius album, not so much as on this album, but I didn't really feel like it could hold a candle to Perfume Genius, to be honest. It's at first I really disliked it, but I grew to see some things that I appreciated more as I went along, but I certainly didn't particularly enjoy it, I have to say.
Yeah. Neil?
Well, we've already said, like, the voice is the key selling point for James Blake. You know, it's a phenomenal voice. When he sort of really lets rip, it's quite spine-tingling. I think, and again, I can't really comment on his entire body of work, but based on this record, to me, I just didn't always feel that the composition, either of like the actual songs that have been put together or the production necessarily displayed that voice in the best way. There were a lot of songs that could, you know, possibly blend together, particularly over a 17-track album. We reviewed Anna Meredith a wee while back and did her album, and I think the composition that she was doing with orchestral arrangements, and actually in some cases quite similar instruments, just so much more interesting and much more energetic than anything that was kind of on this album. I thought as well that there were certain tracks. There's a track called Timeless that had a really kind of interesting sort of halfway through repeated refrain that really kind of got in your head and brought a kind of jarring, discordant kind of element to it, which was really, really interesting. But there just wasn't enough kind of rough in there. And also there weren't enough time changes either, I thought, to move it into different directions. It went a lot along the same tempo with beats that sometimes were just not particularly exciting. And you know, from someone who's come from the dubstep scene, I know it's very sparse, but I would have expected the beats and the bass to be doing a lot more kind of interplay and a lot more powerful. I don't know if with this record he's maybe trying to do something which is a bit more traditional to take him away from those kind of dubstep roots. I think overall, across like an album of that length, there just wasn't quite enough diversity to engage me.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned dubstep because, I mean, I guess the person who's the main purveyor of it is Burial, and who I love, I absolutely love. And I think actually as time's gone on, he's been more and more challenging and done more and more interesting things with some of his later EPs. And it's interesting talking about British dance or electronic music that Blake has called a track Timeless, which of course was the title of Goldie's album back in the day. And Goldie, although seen as a bit of a joke figure, mainly because of some of his kind of celebrity antics, drum and bass, I think, you know, was actually something that had a lot more to be proud of maybe than what dubstep's turned up. I think it really did for a period in that kind of late 90s produce some really, really excellent and distinctively sort of British stuff without wishing to sound like Nigel Farage. So I think, I think it is interesting, but it's so much in the kind of admire rather than like thing. And then I found when I was listening to it earlier on, it's just a little bit annoying. You know, that's the thing, you know, like the voice after a while just becomes too much. And Ben, I can't sort of stop talking about James Blake without giving you a chance to expound a little about his collaborator on that track, I Need a Forest Fire, Bon Iver, because you're not really a fan.
No, I like the first Bon Iver album. I didn't like the second one, and it's largely because he changed direction and there was so much manipulation of the voice. So that's particularly what I don't like about this album. I think he's clearly got a strong voice and a distinctive voice, but it's so processed in a lot of places.
Have these people not heard Cher?
Yeah.
Once you hear that, you can never go back, with auto-tune, you know?
All the vocal, I mean, I was...
I think with someone like James Blake, when you hear his voice untreated, it's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
So, why do you need to cover it up with these effects that just dilute the power of it, you know? I understand they're maybe interesting kind of sonics you want to explore, but I just don't think that's the way to get to them.
I mean, I was getting very annoyed by the vocal manipulation, and then Bon Iver turned up, and I thought, oh, that figures. But I mean, the key track in sort of what you're just saying there, Neil, is the last track, Meet You in the Maze, which is a cappella. There's no music on it at all. I think I read about this before I actually listened to it, saying how it's a beautiful, you know, a cappella track. But the vocal is so heavily processed again. You know, that would, because it's a cappella, that suggests it's going to be a sort of naked song, it's going to be exposed. But the voice is so heavily processed elsewhere. It sort of seems to me somebody actually wants to hide behind the effects rather than actually.
Yeah.
Whereas if you listen to Perfume Genius, there's not any treatment on those vocals generally.
No.
I don't think James Blake has necessarily got any worse voice.
No.
But it just really doesn't do it for me, all these effects.
I think there's sometimes where on the album there's a track called Choose Me, which I think sort of two-thirds in, where there's a choir that he's singing alongside, and all the different voices coming in and interacting with his voice, which at times reminded me of Jeff Buckley when he was really, you know, going for it live, is incredible and works really, really well. But I think the need to sort of try and put different things onto the vocals and on top of the kind of often quite simple, straight ahead composition, you know, just ends up detracting from the songs rather than adding to them.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to mention Choose Me because that is my favourite song on the album. I think it's really good. So yeah, maybe if he'd pared it down to 9-10 tracks, I would say it's been a little bit of an element of a grower about it as well. You know,
a little bit. I did quite like the first song from the start, Radio Silence. That's good. About relationship breakdown. There's also a good song called Waves No Shores, which. It's a good song for me, partly because I like this image. The line is, "You want to know me like waves, no shores." It's quite a nice simile, but that kind of stands out for me because I didn't find the rest of the lyrics particularly interesting, which is not great when it's such a vocally led album, really.
Definitely.
But yeah.
Right, okay, well, having stepped outside our comfort zone and found it to be a little bit too uncomfortable, I'd like to say goodbye at the end of this pod. Just a few words on the coordinates. To listen, soundingboard.podbean.com. You can download from there. You can also just listen on your phone or your iPad or whatever device you're using. To subscribe, iTunes, and we would encourage people to do that. And if you can leave a review on iTunes, I'm told that does make quite a big difference in terms of getting us a slightly wider listenership. Email address is soundingboard@gmx.com. Twitter @soundingboard69, and we're really pleased with the interaction we've had on Twitter, and we've come across a lot of good kind of blogs and podcasts that we didn't know about in recent weeks that we want to kind of continue to give a good plug to, because there's loads and loads of good stuff going on out there. We've also got a presence on Facebook. So I'm Rob Langham, and my cohorts today have been Neil Kennedy and Ben Woolhead. Thank you very much. We should be back in a few weeks' time with episode 7. We'll be right back.